Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Harry Gumby, for coming here to have an interview with us. We appreciate it a great deal. This is December the 6th, 2011. This interview is taking place in Mr. Gumby's home in Grandview, Missouri. Mr. Gumby, let's just start out with some basic questions and asking some of your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Mount Holly Springs, Pennsylvania. That's a small town. Oh, maybe 1,100, 1,200 people in the whole town where I grew up. It was a rural area between Harrisburg, the capital, and Gettysburg, which of course was famous for its Civil War years, and 90 miles from Washington, D.C.
What schools did you go to in that area?
Yeah, in that area I went to the Mount Holly Springs School, which was 9 grades. Now back in those days, when you finished the 9th grade, that was all the schooling that you got, unless you went to another town 6 miles away called Carlisle, but there was no bus transportation or anything. You either had to hitchhike or walk or live with a relative in there. But when you finished the 9th grade, you were finished schooling in that town, and the requirement was that you didn't have to go to any more school. So I did that, and I completed high school while I was in the military.
When you were at this school, was it racially integrated?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. It had been racially integrated about, my older sister, who was 12 years older than me. So she was the first or second black to go to that school, to go to the integrated part. Mm-hmm. Up until then, they had a small school that they called the colored school in the town, and that's where black people went to school. But so I would imagine, she's 12 years older than me, so
so it was probably the first part of the century they began.
First part of the century, yeah. Right, right. Yeah, it would have to be long enough.
What kind of work did your parents do?
Okay.
When you were growing up?
Yeah. My daddy was a farmer, a huckster. We had a big garden, and we planted vegetables and everything like that in the summer and sold them, and that was part of our income. Then he worked as a boilerman at a paper mill. Mount Holly Springs had 2 paper mills, and they were located there because of the pure water. Everybody drank mountain water. It ran right out from under the mountain and all that, so they caught this water and they made this paper. So he was a boilerman there, and what he did was stoked up the boilers that ran the plant. And then he did that for a long time, and then later on, I guess when I was somewhere around 12, 15 years old, he got a job at the state capitol in Harrisburg as a janitor, and he kind of worked there until retirement.
What, did your mother work outside the home?
Yeah, Mama worked, did day's work outside the home, and then she also took in washing and ironing. All the ladies did around that. That was a way of income. And then she, we had the job of cleaning the Mount Holly Springs Library. And I was one of the ones. When I go by that place now, I tell the children, I said, I don't even want to look in there. I dusted so many of them books. And it was my job to keep the books dusted. And so Mama got paid for cleaning up the library. And us boys, I had 5 brothers. We all off and on worked in there. And so we helped her. But she was domestic and a wonderful person. And the educator of the family. Mama went to school with the Jim Thorpe people way back there. And so she had a pretty good education.
When you say she went to school with a Jim Thorpe, what do you mean?
Well, yeah, Jim Thorpe was a Native American who lived in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and went to the Native American school on there. And so when Mama came along, that's where they went to school too.
Was your mother also Native American?
No, she was she was black. No, she was. No, she wasn't. She wasn't a Native American.
So Native Americans and blacks were attending the same school.
Same school. Yeah. And that school is still there, incidentally. The building is still there.
Is that right? Now, what church did you?
We went to church. Well, went two churches. We went to churches all day. In the morning, Dad was a Methodist, Mom was a Baptist. So in the morning, we took off to the Methodist church, and then we ended up that night at the Baptist church. And so we were in church just about all day. Well, that was your recreation back in those days. You know, you didn't, you know, you were either classified as a good boy or not. You know,
right,
so
right.
You were good if you went to church, did what your parents did, stayed out of trouble, that sort of thing. And of course, we did that. Now, my brother and I, the church is still standing. I was up home in October, and the stove that I used to stoke as a boy, 11 or 12 years old, is still in that church. The church is closed now because of all the people. I would imagine, when I grew up in the town, there may have been 150 blacks, but it's down now to... just mostly my family there now. And so they go to church in Carlisle, which is 6 miles away. And the church building's still standing there. And I was telling my sister, when I got back home, she was saying that somebody wanted to rent the building and do something with it. I said, well, you should have told me that while I was there. So they're going to get me in touch with this guy, and I'm going to see if we can turn this over to him, if I can get him to, you know, get it. It needs a lot of fixing up and things like that.
What was the name of the church?
It's called the Mount Tabor A.M.E. Zion Church. Mount Tabor was one of the great mountains in the Bible. The Mount of Olives, Mount Moriah, Mount Tabor, they're all in the Old Testament.
Right.
And so that's where, and churches was named after, especially African American churches, always carried
and
that
this
name.
This is A.M.E. Zion.
A.M.E. Zion. Yeah. Now the difference between, and I found this out later, the blacks had three different Methodist churches. The A.M.E. Zion, which was the mother church, the M.E., and the C.M.E.
Right.
Okay? And and I found out later by traveling through the South about the M.E. and the C.M.E. I didn't know about those while I was growing up in Pennsylvania. It was all A.M.E. And we had our own presiding elder, our own bishop, and all that sort of thing.
What was the name of the Baptist church?
The Baptist church was Shiloh, which was partially built by my grandfather, my mother's daddy.
Really?
Yes, sir. And he was quite a veteran. And Roz has got some history on him, too. He was a soldier way back there and fought the Concho and them guys way back there. And came to Pennsylvania and settled up there. Was a Mason, and his name is really on the wall of the church.
You know? Is that right?
His name was Parker, and Roz has got a pretty good history on him. So we went to Shiloh in the afternoon, Shiloh Baptist Church. It's still standing. It's still flourishing. And it's gotta be years old, you know, because my mother went there. Mama lived to be, I don't know, 86 or something like that. So,
anything you remember about going to school? Did you enjoy anything in particular?
Oh yeah, I enjoyed school. let me tell you this, and I found this out. Okay, I went in the Army with a ninth grade education. Mm-hmm. And, I was better equipped than fellows that I met who had completed high school and some of them a couple years of college. we learned something in those nine grades. In those years that we when we went from one to nine.
Right.
And we had my worst subject, my hardest subject, and I still don't like it, was algebra. But I had two brothers who were so good at math, algebra, geometry, trig, and all that stuff, that they were tutors while they were students going to school. Isn't that amazing? And one finally became a chemist. He has a PhD. Yeah, he's still living. He's in Rochester. And the other one became a school administrator in New Jersey. And both of these guys, I'm telling you, they were wizards at this stuff.
Who were your siblings? Who were your brothers and sisters?
Okay, and my oldest brother, we were all in one family. All had the same mother and same daddy. Mama then was married 65 years before Mama passed. She passed first. And now my oldest sister, she finished the ninth grade. Then she went to high school in this little town called Carlisle. And she went to live with a relative, because they had aspirations, and some of the other people had gone to become teachers and nurses. And back in them days, they had a school called a normal school. And I don't know what it meant, but they called it Shippensburg Normal. It was a teaching school, I think it was. So they went to the school, and if you come out of this normal school and became a nurse and whatever, a professional, you were considered to be in tall cotton with a short hose, as they used to say. It's way up there, you know what I mean? And so my sister Mary Evelyn, she went through all of this. And smart as a whip. And then she had 12th grade. Raymond, the next oldest, only went through the ninth. And he did well when he got out of school. For some reason, he missed the service. I don't know how he missed it. But he became sheriff of one of the counties there and did well. Then I had a brother, George, who was next. Now he was he could run. And back during those days, years ago, they had a fellow named, a black guy named Jesse Owens. And if you know the history of Jesse Owens, he stood before, he beat the Germans in a relay, and Hitler never forgot that. So from that, he didn't like black soldiers, so that got traced itself into the army. And so when the black soldiers went to Germany, you know, well, they gave the Germans a tough time because of the Jesse Owens thing. And, you know, one of those things where, you know, somebody tells a tale and it carries on and on and on and gets into the culture and never gets out. And so, but George was a runner. Oh, he could move. I tell you the truth. I saw him myself. Back in those days, during the 4th of July, we used to light firecrackers. That was fun. And we had a firecracker like four or five inches long. And they'd light that firecracker. And George would see how far he could run before that thing went off. And I'm telling you, they clocked him as being way away from that thing. He could get down and move. Well, we think that they're running in, you know, he died young. I think the running is what killed him. And then my brother John, who went in the army a year or so before I did, did well, but he came back out, then went to the government and worked for 43 years for the government, and he retired. And then my other brother, Ed, was the educator in New Jersey, and then William, who is the industrial chemist, worked for an outfit called Bosch and Lomb in New York. And he was in on the he was on the very first the little rings they used to put in your eyes,
right?
You know? Yeah.
Right, I know. That's what I thought you were going to do.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
Your eyes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. With that.
Right.
Yeah. He was one of the guys that helped make the first ones of those things.
Right.
Now I'm telling you, that's really getting down. You know.
Contact.
Yeah. Yeah. Contact lens.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Bosch and Lomb made a lot of other stuff.
Right, uh-huh.
laboratory stuff and high-tech equipment and all that kind of mess. And so he worked for them for years. And then...
Where did he go to school?
Oh, yeah. He went to school at Penn State.
Really?
Yes, sir. He went two schools. He finished the Mount Holly School, three schools. Then he went to Carlisle to the high school. Now, by the time William came along, they had transportation to go from my little town over to Carlisle, which was 5 or 6 miles. So he had a way in and out back home. So he went to school there. Then he went to a college called Dickinson College, which is in Carlisle, an old-time, well-known law school. He graduated from there, and then he went to Penn State up in the State College. Incidentally, I have a grandson up there going to State College now.
Right.
Who's going after his doctorate.
At Penn State?
Yeah, and he's...
field is he in?
He's a clinical guy, clinical psychologist. I call him a head shrinker, you know. And I tease him a lot. And he said, "Gramps, now, you know," he said, "I'm really not." I said, "Well, you know," I told him one day, I said, "you know," I said, "we used to take all the clinical psychologists and the head shrinkers," and I said, "well, we'd put them in the front line when we were in the Army." He said, "Now, Gramps, what'd you do that way, sir? You telling me the truth?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well," I said, "because, you know, we ain't got no time for him to put us through a clinical course when that enemy's shooting at us. So we put him up here to make sure we knew where he was." So we get a big charge out of that. But I don't really think that was done. Some of the guys said it was, but I don't think it was done. But anyhow, William worked there, and then he got tired of that. And you know what that guy's doing now? He left all that. And he just kind of walked away. I guess he got a pension and all that from it.
Sure.
But he runs a senior citizens housing place.
Great.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, that's great.
And I said, "Well, now, William, how can you?" "Oh," he said, "I'm having a ball."
I've been so. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's good, but he knows what they need.
Yeah. And he works religiously at that thing too. But anyhow, that's the side of the boys. The girls did well, too. And several of them were teachers and worked in the government, things like that. And the war, when it came, World War II, you know, I guess made a lot of us, took us away from the domestic scene and the drudgery of working in somebody's kitchen or on somebody's farm. And we got to get out and get in industry and do some things and see some things that otherwise probably wouldn't have happened.
Now, how did you said your father earned a living from being a huckster.
Uh-huh.
Did he maintain the farm throughout his life, or?
Let's see. We stopped farming. Let's see when we really stopped farming. I guess when the war broke out, because all through the Depression, we raised vegetables and sold them. And up to about 1941 or so, along in there, I guess we kind of kept things rolling. And then from then on, you know, we got rid of the, had a mule and a horse. And so Ted, somebody talked him into raising guinea pigs for laboratory research. So he took off doing that. So... which was an awful thing, you know, and we'd get on it when we went home. We said, "Man, what are you doing fooling them mice, you know, and them rodents?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "the government needs them." And so he was raising them. They were hauling them off somewhere, selling them. So he did that, but he still, by that time, he had been working, I think, in Harrisburg. And he worked up until he's like 85, you know, all this kind of stuff. He just couldn't quit working. But that's kind of the way he made
it. So yeah. did you all sell the farm, or?
No, we still own it.
You still own it?
Still own it, yeah.
Are they still working it with vegetables?
No, it's all in grass and woods.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is the house is gone?
No, the house is gone, yeah. We tore the house. It was a log house covered with wood, and then later we covered it with this plastic stuff. And we found all kinds of things we tore. The house has been down now about 5 years. the city said we either had to restore it, and of course there was nobody there to live in it. We had built a new home, and that's where my sisters live now. They live in the new house. But we still own the land and everything. Yeah.
So when you said World War II came, tell me, when is the earliest memory you have about the war, hearing about the war?
The first time I paid attention to the war was on December the 7th, which is tomorrow, and I was at my little girlfriend's house, and they said Pearl Harbor has been bombed. And I said, what in the world is Pearl Harbor, and where is that? I never heard about no Pearl Harbor. Oh, I knew about Hawaii and that sort of thing. And I was pretty good at geography and that sort of stuff. And I knew, you know, that the war was raging and all that, but it hadn't really touched us. Very few of the people around the little town where I was had gone to war until, of course, we were attacked by the Japanese. Then it broke wide open. So then, it was on a Sunday, and I will forget, Sunday evening, and I was around, I was chasing this little lady, and so I had known her for some time and all this sort of thing. They said, well, Pearl Harbor, Pearl. So then she said, well, I guess you're going to have to go to the Army. And I said, oh, no. I said, what would I do in the Army? I said, I'm not a soldier. I'm a farmer, you know. And he said, oh, yeah, well. That lasted 2 years. Let's see, 41 they attacked it, and 43 I was in. And I was in the service. And I tell you what had happened. I'd finished school and everything, and I'd gone to work down at this. The Navy was building a great big depot down there. And they said that if you worked at this depot, you were supposed to be, you were war something, you know, you were defense prone. You wouldn't have, you know, that was your job as long as you stayed there. So, cocky, you know, a young cocky, mouthy fella, you know, the boss and I, we had a little round, you know, and I told him, well, you know, man, I don't have to work here. No, I can do this, do that, and the other. And he said, you have to stay right here. And he said, if you leave here, he said, I'm going to turn your name in, and then they're going to draft you. And so I said, well, we'll see about that. And one word led to another. And you know how boys can be cocky and mouthy. But sure enough, he did. I left and went to another job. And 2 weeks later, my notice came. And I was drafted. Left home and went back a couple of times. Well, the first time when I got out of the service, I went back home and everybody else was getting out. So all the jobs was taken up, everything like that. I didn't think about going to school. I said, well, I think I'll go back in. And I had gotten a little bit of rank by that time. I was a staff sergeant. I had four stripes. So somebody said, well, you come on back in and, you know, study and all this and everything, and maybe we can get you a commission and give you a re-enlistment bonus and all that kind of stuff they do when they want to entice you to do something, you know, and so you kind of fall for that, you know, and so I did all that, and in the meantime, when I was in there, they sent me down to Texas, and I'd met Miss Gumby. She was going to school. Well, it so happened down there that the soldiers, a bunch of soldiers, just before we got there, had came in there a month or so before that, and went downtown and tore up the town. So people in uniform weren't very well liked around there. Well, I was always the fellow that kind of hung around the church and all this sort of thing. So I said, well, I've got to go to church. I can't deal with no chapel, so I'll go to church in town. So I always used to be a pretty good singer back then. And so I got together four or five fellows, and we formed what we called a quartet. We were really five of us. And I was the manager. So we took this five group of fellows around town, and we'd go to singing in soldiers, in these churches. Well, the word got out, you know, saying, hey, them boys must be all right. You know, they go to church and they sing and the crowd follows them. And said, well, we just get them in there. Well, it so happened that Miss Gumby, you know, the little lady that I was tracing, I tell the children this all the time, I kind of had an eye for her, so being in charge, we sang at her church more than any place. So her daddy loved that, you know. He was the minister. So he kind of fronted for me, you know, and he saw really that I was all right. Just like anybody else, I was in uniform, you know, and we all were, man. They had so many people in uniform back then. It was something else. And so one thing led to another, and then they sent her on off to college, you know. She went to a black college up at Marshall called Bishop College. I don't even think it exists anymore. But she had 2 years of college and all that. And so they tried to get me to go to school. I said, I'm in the Army, you know. I'm a soldier. I can't be doing no schooling and stuff like that, you know. And I said, you know, I just fiddle along like I'm going now, you know. And did that. And lo and behold, in her second year up there, we jumped up and we get married. And We were married 58 years before I lost her. She's the only husband I had, she was the only wife that I had.
That's great. But how would you describe in Mount Holyoke, Holly Springs? How would you describe race relations in the community when you were growing up?
Oh, we were separated. Let me tell you about that. And I tell people this all the time. We lived across the tracks. We lived on the east side of town. Most of the blacks lived on the east side of town. There was maybe two or three families that lived on the west side of town. But they had been there so long that, you know, everybody knew them. They were just kind of educated in that. But over where we lived, and I was telling Ron the other day that she still can't get actually what happened. The street leaving the main part of Mount Holly, coming over to where I lived, where we lived, was Pine Street. And then when it turned and came down to where we lived, they renamed the street Mountain Street, but they call it Smoky Row. Okay? And so she said, well, Dad, why'd they do it? I said, well, I don't know. I said, that was long before I was born, I guess, it was done. And so then later on they renamed the streets, and of course it then became Mountain Street all the way down. Well, now, over where we lived on the east side, when I left home to go to the Army, we did not have electricity. We did not have a telephone. We did not have gas, natural gas. We did not have water. None of those things did we have. The water came to the end of Pine Street and stopped. From then on, where the black people lived, we didn't have that. So while we were in the service, we started fighting for what we felt we should have. And we went to the state health department. We jumped over the city, the county, and everybody else and said, we need water on our street. We need electric. We need everything else that everybody else got. Okay? And as a boy, we used to get our water from these springs, you know, and we'd haul it in big cans called a milk can or a large can, and we'd get these cans of water. Then we had a cistern where the water ran off the roof into the cistern, and we used that to wash clothes in, but we didn't drink it or use it for consumption. We used this other water. So that was kind of a form of segregation. The other was We went through economic segregation. Whenever they wanted somebody to do menial tasks, they came over in our street and got them. Dig ditches, clean toilets, anything like that. Okay. The town was primarily Republican, devoted Republican. And there was one or two people around there that ran everything. Well, this is an interesting thing. This is going to slay you. You could not get a loan, a black person when I grew up, you could not get a loan from a bank in Mount Holly Springs unless it was signed for by a white person. Okay? Even though we were property owners, I guess they think our property wasn't worth much, or probably that nobody would buy it. I don't know. Yeah, we owned our land where we lived. We actually owned it. We had 3 acres and 3.5 acres, and we owned it. And had title to it, had deed to it, everything. Couldn't borrow no money. So, listen to this. Mama was such a friendly person that I don't know of anybody in town that did not like her. At least if it did, I never heard of them. And they would come and consult her on different things that happened in the community and things like that. You know? And she would sit and talk to them and all this kind of thing. And when any of the other black boys in town got in trouble or something like that, they would come over to Miss Gumby and say, well, so-and-so. And she said, well, you know, he's all right. He's just like, you know, any other boy, you know. He's mischievous, you know, and gets into this and did that. And so as long as he hasn't done anything illegal or harmful, you know, I'll let him go. You know, okay, Miss. All right. In the town, there was a family. There was a pharmacist named J. Raymond Snyder. And his wife's name was Edna Snyder. My oldest brother was named from him. His name was J. Raymond Snyder. See the connection? One of my sisters was named Edna Snyder. In other words, when Mom had these babies, these ladies, these people, you know, she named them after these people. She admired them and they admired her. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. J. Edward, if we needed a loan, I don't remember my daddy ever borrowing any money, but if he did, J. Edward would sign off for it. Now that's real. I don't know what you call it. Mm-hmm. But it's,
and did your mother work in their home?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she worked for them. And not only that, they always kept her in a job. You know, she always had the job, bless her heart, she did, she was good at doing ironing, washing and ironing. And all the prominent people, men brought their shirts over there, the ladies brought the shirts for Bob to do up. So she was good at that. And didn't get nothing for it. I guess the shirt back in them days, she got a quarter maybe for doing it.
Well, that was still a lot of money.
Had a lot of money back then.
Right.
Had a lot of money back then. But that's how we kind of grew up. So we were, Mama always taught us that, you know, better days would come, you know, and that this thing would equal out and that we would have to endure some hardships. And she used the Bible, different things, you know. Paul, for example, she was a caller, Paul. Paul endured great hardships and went through a whole lot of stuff. And so we were taught that, you know, don't go around with a chip on your shoulder. Things will change. People will change. And the other thing she taught us, that when we do get in a position where we can do like we've been done, then don't do that. Because you know how it feels.
Right.
Well, that kind of state, I tried to teach my children that, and I noticed my children tried to teach theirs that. It's kind of got the way with some of the grandchildren, you know. It's entirely a new day, and they're influenced by the culture around them, and you know how it is in college.
So you did not, although you went to the school which was integrated,
mm-hmm.
did you have any classmates who were white that
yes.
were friends?
Yes. Let me tell you what happened. They were friendly until it came to the point where they had a party and I wasn't invited. Okay. And you could see that were the parents. Even though they, and later in years, you know, when I went home, I was a highly decorated veteran. And when I finally went home, I'd go to see some of my classmates and people like that, you know. And they say, oh, man, they call me by my nickname. They say, oh, boy, I said. And one of them would even feel sorry. Say, you know, I said, oh, man, you know. I said, the Apostle Paul said, you know, look forward, never backward. Don't look back. I mean, those days were gone. It's a new day, you know. Make certain that you treat these people that you're dealing with now in the way you would like to have a treat. But we had one family there that really later on became really, really good friends of my sister's. And they were Tishers, and they had come up from Florida in the early 40s, and late 30s, early 40s. And Sue and I were in the same grade and everything like that. And she used to look off my paper and get answers and things like that. But when they had birthday parties and things like that, even at recess, we all played together.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just where, you know, the boy and the girl, the white boy and the black boy, it just didn't gel.
When you were growing up, did you ever hear anything about race riots or civil rights protests?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We knew about that. And I'll tell you how we knew about it. The Philadelphia paper came out every week. And it was called the Philadelphia Afro-American. It was a black newspaper. And had two of them. And one come out of Philadelphia, one come out of Pittsburgh. And, of course, they pretty much kept up with the stories around. So we knew about it. But we didn't really, you hear about the wind and all that kind of stuff. But you never know about the wind until you feel it. You see what I mean? So it was far-fetched, and we used to laugh, in other words, I was cautioned when I went to the Army. You know, they said, now listen, when you get out in Virginia, said, remember, you can't pass a white person on the sidewalk. Said, if you go on the sidewalk there and a white woman comes on the sidewalk, you get off and walk in the street. I never had to do that. You know, and I never seen anybody that did it down there. I got out into Maryland and Virginia and different places and went on about my business, you know. But it was kind of a...
So you learn your things from the Pittsburgh Courier and the Philadelphia Afro-American.
Yeah, the Philadelphia Afro.
Let's talk about what were the circumstances surrounding your entry into World War II?
The what?
What were the circumstances? You already said that you got dismissed from the job and
got
a draft.
Yeah,
and
got a draft.
What did your parents think when you got that draft?
Well, they didn't. They never wanted us to go to war. They never wanted any of us boys to go to the Army. They felt it was a white man's war. And that we had no business fighting. And you didn't have the great stress like President Obama puts on it, God bless America, and we're all Americans, and yeah, this is America. Even though we ain't got it like it should be, it's still America, and we're still the best. Well, We didn't look at that. We looked at it as being two Americans. Okay. Even in the Army, it was like that. And so they said, okay, when you get in there, they just thought the Army was a dreadful thing. And my dad just never really did get over it because of, he didn't say much, to me about it. when I went in, other
were
than...
Were you the first son to go to war?
No, I was the second one, go ahead. I was the second one. Yeah, the one went in for me. And Dad used to say, you know, just remember your training. And he says, you know, you have sort of a temper. He says, you can't, you got to control that now. I said, yeah, Dad, I will. And all this kind of thing. And he said, don't ever do anything that would make us ashamed of you. And I remember that.
When you went off to war, did they have a, you know, some kind of send-off gatherings or
no,
parties?
No. My mother and my niece, who was 7 years old at the time, we walked to the bus over to the middle of town, got on the bus, hugged and kissed, and said goodbye. And I was off to war. I rode into Carlisle. I went from Carlisle to Harrisburg to the induction station. And from there to Fort George G. Meade, Maryland. This was all in one day. And I got there about 9 o'clock at night on this troop train. We backed up in there. And the first thing I heard was, fall out over here. I didn't even know what that meant. Get on over here. Blah, 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 blah.
So were you with men who were black and white, or were they all...
Well, let me tell you what happened. I left with, and there was a family that lived up in the mountain by the name of Niels. And the Niels were white. They were white. But they were raised black. Now, this is a funny phenomenon that I'm telling you about, but it does happen sometimes. And there was black in their family, but this Neil boy was pure white. Pure white. He could pass for white anywhere. And so we landed in Fort Meade together. And we knew one another. And then when we left there to go to Basic, which was a little old place down in the mountain called Camp Pickett, Virginia, we got in there that night, and the next morning, I looked over and Neil's bed was empty, and he was gone. And I said to the guy that came in here, we lived in this a little old shack, they call them Hutmans. Mm-hmm. And you was in there with 8 guys and a corporal, a two-striper. Mm-hmm. So I said, where's my friend Neil? And he said, oh, he said, he ain't here. He said he was transferred. I said, what do you mean transferred? I said, we came in here together. He said, yeah, but you're going to stay here. He said, Neil went over with the white people. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, well, he was white, wasn't he? I said, well, yeah, I guess he was. That's all I said. There wasn't no need of me trying to, because he was, and he was, and he had blonde hair in it, but he was raised colored. I never saw that boy again. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know whether later on a bunch of them same guys I went with were the first batch to go overseas, and I missed out on that because they picked me as part of the cadre. And I don't know why they did that. I guess it was doing it. Well, I always say it was the Lord's doing. And they were gone. But back in Mount Holly, they were going as colored. And he grew up colored. That's what happened to him.
When you responded to your draft notice, you went to where now?
Yeah, I went into Carlisle. Okay. That was the... That was a place where we all got on this big bus, and we went to the induction station, which was in Harrisburg.
Uh-huh. What was that like? What did you have to do?
Oh, that was a mess. That was a mess. We went down there, and that's where they took all your civilian clothes from me. Wrapped them up, said, send these back home, and they put you in a uniform. Back in them days, you had to wear a uniform. And then they sent us. They put us all on the train then, and like a bunch of cattle, and set us down to this place, Fort George G. Meade, Maryland.
When you were in that, when you were in the induction process, were there African Americans there telling you what to do? You know, those who were guiding you through packing up your clothes and doing that?
No, they were all white people.
All white.
They were all white. I didn't meet. I didn't contact black people in charge until I got into basic training. That's when I finally met them.
When you put your uniform on, what did you do? You remember how you felt about it?
Well, you know, we had a lot of fun. You know.
When you first put it on,
yeah.
What did you think?
Well, I thought, my goodness, I'm gonna have to wear this bully woolly stuff the rest of my life. You know, that's what you thought. And then you didn't think too much about home. One of the things that we were raised up to, up until I was 19, you know, I had never really been out the state of Pennsylvania. You know, it was that kind of thing. We were just home people. We all stayed around close to home because...
How old were you when you got that draft notice?
I was 19. But there was just a bunch of us guys around there, but they did, when we went to the induction station, it was both black and white, and of course then...
Okay, Mr. Gumby, we were talking about how did you know, when you were separated from all the soldiers, how did you know where to go from...
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think where we filled out these papers. Well, that was at the induction station where that happened.
Mm-hmm.
When they filled out your service record, they had... Were they using colored or Negro?
It doesn't make any difference. One of the two.
They were using one of them. Yeah, they were. They had white, colored, Native American, and Puerto Rican. Now, the interesting thing about it, a lot of the Puerto Ricans were black, just like me. But they were called Puerto Ricans, not Negroes or not colored people. Maybe it's because they spoke Spanish, I don't know. But I'm still trying to figure that one out. Yeah, but they had a Puerto Rican. And then later on they picked some more races, like Hawaiian, Asiatic, you know,
when you fill that out, then that determined where you would go.
Where you would go, that's right. And all of the blacks, all of the coloreds went one way to be trained, and the whites went to another portion to be trained.
And so where did you receive your training?
I received my training in Camp Pickett, Virginia. Camp Pickett, Virginia. And I was trained by, in the company I was trained in, was white officers and black non-commissioned officers. White officers and black non-commissioned officers. Now, that was an interesting thing. You really had to watch out there. You had to be careful there, because the officers were mostly from the South. And they treated us just like they had treated the Southern people that they grew up to. The culture was they were in charge, and they were here and we were there, okay? The only difference was that between the white officer and us was a non-commissioned officer who was black. So right then and there, I guess almost the first day that I got there, first week that I got in there, I said to myself, "Now, you know, if I'm to make it in this thing at all, I'm gonna have to become a non-com. We call it non-commissioned officer. We call it non-coms. And so what I did was I did a lot of studying. They put you, back in those days, they put you through what they call the school of a soldier, just like going to regular school. Started in first grade, graduated in the eighth or ninth. Okay? And all during them grades, you learn certain things. And by the time I had finished basic training, now this is how much I learned about the Army. They had a book of instructions there called the ARD, the Army Regulation Directives. I knew half of that book and could recite it. Well, that impressed somebody, because we had 9 weeks of training. When about, during the sixth or seventh week, they said to me, this officer did. He was white officer, and he couldn't talk very well. He pronounced my name like it had an A in Gamby. Instead of Gumby, it was Gamby. He said, Gamby. And I said, yes, sir. You know, you had to say sir to him and all that kind of mess, you know. And he said, I've been watching you. And I started to tell him, I've been watching you too, but I didn't. And so he said, you'd make a good NAMCOM. I said, well, thank you, sir. You know. And he said, so about 2 weeks after that, let me tell you what they did. They made me an acting NAMCOM, an acting corporal. Okay. Now, what they did, I laugh about that to this day. They had these two stripes on a band. And, of course, they could bust you or bring you up or down. And so as long as you put this thing on with two stripes on, you had authority. You were higher than the other fellows. Okay? And there was no question that was it. So I said, okay, so it was the longest time before I was able to really sew them on my clothes, you know, and or get paid for them, you know. I just acted as a non-com. And under these other non-commissioned officers and these white officers. Well, it so happened that the non-commissioned officers were fellows who had come out of the 9th and 10th Cavalry. And they were the Buffalo soldiers, 9th and 10th. And they ate and slept and walked soldiery. It was a vocation, just like you were a teacher or whatever you were. That's what they were just dyed-in-the-wool soldiers. And they were impressed that I was able to learn the Army regulations so fast that I took the time to do that. But what they didn't know is I'm trying all I can to get away from the humdrum, you know? And so never will forget, there was a guy, there was three fellas, and they all came out of the 25th Infantry, the 25th Infantry Division, which was an all-black unit with some black officers, but mostly the highest-ranking officers were white. Now, I didn't serve in any of the infantry units, but I served under people who came out of there, and I'm telling you, they were dandies. So, had this guy named Willie Williams, never will forget. And Willie kind of took a liking to me. And he said, boy, he said, you're smart. He said, you. Then another thing I used to do, and I'll get back to my main story, there was a lot of those guys in there that couldn't read or write. And the saddest thing that you ever want to see is when they have mail call, and a guy gets a letter and he can't read it or can't answer. So I found several of those fellas. And these were guys that knew something about the Army, too, that I could learn from. And I would write letters for them, and then letters come and read for them, you know, and everything. And they could write their name, but that was all. They had learned to write their name. Some of them used an X, but most of them could write their name. But they were good soldiers. They were top-notch. And knew the book and all this kind of stuff. Had one guy from Mississippi, the Delta. Oh, I lost track of him, and I'm so sorry about that. His name was DeLoach, Ollie DeLoach. DeLoach was a great, big, six-foot guy, strong, fierce-looking warrior, you know. And if he told you to shut up, you'd better, because the next thing you know, he was going to shut you up. And I got him on my side, but he couldn't write, and he couldn't read. But he liked to get a lot of mail and stuff like that. And so I'd write for him. And when you get these letters, and so when they call out the mail, they call about Sergeant Ollie DeLoach. He said, "Yeah." Never did say here. "Yeah," he'd say, like it was Y-E-A-R. And boy, he was getting the mail in. So he'd get the mail, and we'd go around behind the barracks or someplace, and I'd read it to him. So he'd say, you know, that guy. He finally, as a matter of fact, there was another guy, and I'm trying to think of his name. He was out of Florida, and he was really smart. He'd gone to Florida A&M. And together we were teaching Ollie how to read, you know, basic reading. Now that's, you know, I had forgot about how you learn to read, you know. And you learn like we learned in the first grade with the first grade book and all that. And he was just so amazed. What in the world was that guy's name? But this guy had gone to Florida A&M, and we were teaching Ollie how to read and all that sort of thing. And he could write his name, but soldier, he could do it. And they used to get him. They used to have him to call the roll for reveille. Now, I'm going to tell you what this guy could do. See, he apparently just didn't have the opportunity to learn. He could have probably been one of the smartest guys in the world. And he would stand up there on that hill and call out every soldier's name and never miss a one. And you couldn't fool him. And when they call it reveille, hey, John Smith, yeah. Either said here or present. Someone would say, "Yeah." And then one time they got up there and they tried to fool old Ollie. They said, you know, and he called out a name. And another guy called him. He said, "Who was that fellow called that last name?" He said, "It wasn't the name I called." He said, "I want him to step out here right now." And he stopped everything until that guy came out there and he put him right out in front. And so he told him, he said, "When I call your name," he said, "you answer. Don't you answer for nobody but you." He said, "Don't you know your own name?" And this guy couldn't read. Just amazing memory. And so we ran into a lot of that. But a lot of these guys had been in the old army, so to speak.
When you said you wanted to pursue this to get away from the humdrum.
Right.
Well, what was the humdrum?
Well, the humdrum was you had to do, you had specific duties that every soldier did. One was kitchen duty, KP. The other was yard bird duty. You had to do the yard. The other was had to work the garbage truck. Soldiers did all this. The other was anytime they broke up camp and moved over to another camp, they had a whole bunch of detail guys. Well, if you were an uncommissioned officer, you didn't have to do none of that. You saw that it was done, but you didn't have to do it.
That was your motive.
Yeah, that was my motive, see. And the other was, I knew that eventually that we would be going to some kind of technical school or other, you know, and that if I had pretty good marks in what I was doing here, that I'd be able to get into it. And sure enough, I did. What what, I mean, this whole process landed me in the medical corps. And when you got in the medical corps, then they sent me off to school to become a first aid man, okay? And they taught us anatomy, physiology, how to fix wounds, give shots, carry morphine. Yeah, man, I'm telling you, I had the morphine pellets and things like that. I had real morphine in them, everything like that. And how to, when a guy was going into shock, how to, you know, and that's, I mean, you give him the morphine before he, to keep him from going into the shock, because the pain is what shocked him out. So we learned all that, and then you also had some hospital training. You had to go in there and do corpsman duty, empty bed pads and all this kind of stuff. And while I was in there, I learned to give shots, and I learned about, you know, dermal, intradermal, muscular, intramuscular, and then intravenous and all this kind of stuff. And I can probably still do it. I've done it in years, but I know how to do it. And so I learned all that. Just gradually progressing. Well, with everything that you learn, you step, you know, you move up, and you move up, you move up, you move up, and you up. And to make a long story short, by the time I left the service, I was the highest enlisted man that there was. I was a chief master sergeant. I had 8 stripes, okay? I was never commissioned because I really never wanted one. I don't know why, but I just, the non-commissioned officer was enough for me. I just never wanted to be an officer. I don't know. It just never occurred to me. You know.
When you were doing this basic training, where did you complete your basic training?
I completed it in Pickett, Camp Pickett, Virginia.
Okay, what was that? Was that camp nice? Was it? Did you know what the white camps looked like?
Oh, yeah. It was separated.
Was the white camp nearby?
Yeah, it was across the street.
Oh, okay.
And had a big fight there one night. Well, what happened was, we had our own exchange over here. PX, you know, that's our own store. We had our own over there, and we had our own little recreation house, service clubhouse. They had theirs over there. So some smart aleck, there was a white boy, came over to ours one day, and I guess to buy cigarettes and things like that, or whatever he came over there for. But a bunch of them got together and ran him out of there. So he went back across the street and told his buddies. He said, I went over there to the PX, and them guys over there chased me out. Said he was going to whip me. That was the kind of the story. So there was a fight broke out. And it was a racial thing. And so they didn't know that we had 2 units on our side that had guns. See, by this time I was in the medical unit, but they had some engineering guys, some combat engineers. These were black boys. Now, the combat engineer group, not only did they dig ditches and make bridges and tear them down and all that, but they also had guns. They had rifles, just like, they had the, what do they call that little gun they had?
Machine gun?
Yeah, machine gun thing like. They had those and all that. And of course, the other side over there was really armed. And you know them soldiers start shooting across one another? So so word got to the general on the post at the riot. And of course, he went down there to see if he could, you know, he was going to stop it and everything. So when they came down there, they shot over his car, I don't think. But it was a mess, you know.
So what was the penalty paid for that misbehavior?
Well, what happened was, about 3 days later, they took all the white boys and they shipped them out and sent them overseas. It was, I think they called them the Dirty Damn Division. There was the DD Division, and the guys had named them the Dirty Damn Division. Or, you know how soldiers give things names. And anyhow, they put these guys and they shipped them all out. And of course, that took care of that, see. But we always had the worst part of the camp. Now, for example, over where the other fellows were in that division, Was there a, is that a dog down there getting there, or is that a possum?
See him
come?
Dog.
That's a dog, yeah. Yeah. Now and then I have possum come through there. I have groundhogs come through there.
That's a dog. Don't shoot him.
I have raccoons come through here.
Yeah.
Yeah, all kind of stuff. And they shipped these guys on out. Oh, what I was about to say is that where we were back over here, we were living in tents. I'm talking about regular tents, canvas tents. Mm-hmm. And no latrine facilities or anything. And over on the other side, they were living in wooden barracks. So, what are you going to do?
So, when those guys got shipped out, where did they leave? What did you guys keep doing?
Well, they shipped us out about 3 weeks later. We left and went to Texas. And they closed that camp. Oh. Yeah, they closed that, and they opened up, well, they had opened up a bigger one down there in Texas, a place called Camp Barkley. And when I got on, that's where I met Miss Cumby down there in Abilene. And we had terrible quarters down there too. They just strictly bad.
Were they worse than the ones where you were, Virginia, or were they about the same?
Well, they let me tell you what they were. Years ago, the government had started camps called CC camps.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right.
Okay, and the CC camps turned into Army camps. And so, Conservation Corps or something like that, I think it was called.
Right.
And so we stayed in the old CC barracks, and you can look out through them just like that, only this got glass there.
Mm-hmm.
Look out through the side, you look up through the rain, and rained on us and everything. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was General Davis, Sr., B.O. Davis, Sr.,
mm-hmm.
Was the only black general we had for a long time. He came down there on a tour. I don't know whether, well, I think what happened, one of the black newspapers got a hold of it, or the NAACP or somebody, anyhow, they wrote this up, how bad we were living down there. So they sent him down there to see this place where we were living. And he's a big general, of course. About a week or two before we got there, well, they found out he was coming. They moved us over into the white area. Into the good barracks.
But where were the white guys?
They had moved out.
Oh,
yeah,
they had moved out.
Well, yeah, now these places were empty all the time. And matter of fact, it was the school where they had the officer candidate down there. And so they moved us into these. Oh, it was just like going from someplace in the Crown Center or the Hyatt, you know. We had running water. We had showers on the inside. We had, bathrooms and stools and everything. And we had the kitchen privileges, lovely mess hall and all this kind of stuff. Well, we just didn't know what to do with ourselves down there. But it happened. And when this general came down there, all he did was just kind of ride through, like, you know. And they had us all standing out at attention the day he come and all that kind of stuff. They didn't play the Stars and Stripes, but I imagine they would have done that, I guess, if somebody would have asked him to. And they did all this just because this guy showed up. But the real change didn't come until Harry Truman got in office. And I remember the day that the order came down to where there would be no more segregated services. And Truman was the guy that did it, and he said, we're going to do this, and we mean it, and anybody that caused any trouble, from the highest to the lowest, I'm going to fire them. Well, we had some little problem, but it didn't last long. But from then on, things really got, now this must have been about 48 or 49, long in there somewhere.
Let's go back. Let's not, if you can hold that thought, and I don't
yeah.
mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, I will.
But let's go just during your experiences during the time of World War II. After this camp, did you stay at this camp throughout World War II?
No. I stayed at that camp in Texas. Let me see. I was down there. I was in Texas. Let me get my thoughts together. I was in Texas twice. The first time I went down there, you know, I was stationed in Texas three times. The first time I went down there, what was the name of that fort down there?
But this was the fort where you had, living in the CC camp.
Right, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, we were in the CC camp. That's right, yeah. Then we left. The next time I went, we were in the, over at the Big General Hospital, Fort Sam Houston.
Okay.
Right.
But where did you go during World War II?
Mostly during the war. See, I didn't get overseas. The first time I got overseas, I didn't get overseas until in the 50s.
Okay. Let's go back to World War II.
Yeah.
Did you serve out all of World War II in Texas at that camp?
No. Most of World War II was done in, some in Texas, mm-hmm. some in Missouri.
Where were you in Missouri, you remember?
Down here in Neosho.
Okay.
Up here in the mountains.
Was that also a segregated camp?
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah.
What was it like? Do you remember anything about it?
Yeah, it was terrible. It was we were way up there in them hills,
mm-hmm.
and we were like, I don't know, maybe 12, 13 miles from Neosho, about 25 miles, I guess, from Joplin. And we used to, on weekends, we used to go, when we get weekend passes, we'd go to Joplin. Or was that Neosho? And we'd catch a train called the Katy, MKT, that came down from Missouri through Kansas into Tulsa. And we'd go over there to see the girls, you know, of course, recreation. Then you had to come back that weekend and going back there. Yeah, so the majority of that was spent in WW2 because that's where I was when I went back to Texas, to Fort Sam. So that had to be about, great day of the morning, 47, long in there somewhere. Yeah, about 47, long in there.
So you were in Missouri, you were in Missouri.
Yeah, I was in Missouri.
Any other places did you serve during the time before 46?
I served in Pickett, and I served in Texas, then I went from Texas to Missouri, and I went back to Texas, and I went back to Texas the third time. I was in the Air Force then.
Okay. Yeah. Well, tell me, during World War II, when they kept moving you, before 46, they kept moving you around,
mm-hmm.
why did they keep moving you around?
Well, what they were doing, they were, they had opened up so many bases, and they had begun to close them.
Mm-hmm.
And as they closed these bases, they would move the soldiers to other stations. Mm-hmm. And I got caught in several of these.
Uh-huh.
They had what they called temporary places, temporary camps, and then they had permanent camps. And the temporary camps, they called them camp so-and-so and so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
The permanent bases, they called them fort so-and-so and so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
So like Fort Sam at Houston, that was a permanent place.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Meade was a permanent place. Pickett, by that time, they had closed it up. And then they were about to close this base down here at in Neosho. It was called it was a temporary camp called Camp Crowder.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever think you were going to be sent overseas during World War II?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You had to be ready. We had our bags packed for a minute's notice to go overseas. We had one barracks bag, which when it was full, it was about this high. And it had everything in it that you owned and that you would need, including your mess gear and your mask thing that you put on for gas,
mm-hmm.
your gas mask, which was the only thing that you strapped over your shoulder. And so when you picked this bag up, put on your hat and coat, you were ready to hit for any place that the government was going to send you.
Did you all ever get wind of that they were going to send you overseas directly, or?
Oh, yeah, we had it all the time. Yeah. We during the time we were down here in Missouri, you know, President Truman was in then. They had a big strike or something like that in St. Louis, and they loaded us all up in trucks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to go to St. Louis and guard the trains. Well, we got just at the last minute before we pulled out, we got word that the strikers behaved themselves and got settled down. We didn't have to go up there. And I sure glad of that, because I didn't want to get into that. When
World War II ended, where were you?
When it actually ended, I was in Longbourn, Ohio. Longbourn Air Force Base, Ohio. That's right at Columbus.
How did you jump from the Army to the Air Force Base?
Well, let me tell you what happened. The second time I went to Texas, I was in what they call it was a great big pool of men.
Mm-hmm.
Just a whole bunch of us. And I got to look at one of my pots, can I?
Sure. I'll stop it right here.
I was living in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, I think we're going. Okay, uh-huh. We're going to have to repeat this. When you were so you never went beyond. You stayed stateside during World War II.
Stateside during World War II, never got in conflict.
Okay, although you were trained as a
trained to do it. Yeah,
trained as combat.
I was trained as a combat medic, and I could do all those things I told you before. I was a corpsman. I went to school, and they had taught me a lot of anatomy and physiology,
mm-hmm.
and I knew about stresses and strains and all that kind of stuff, and I knew about the soldiers who were FGMO, that we call it, but these are guys who were in depression and had lost their minds, how to treat them.
Would you write letters home?
No.
Did you ever write home?
No. I've written a few letters home, you know, to guys that I knew, you know.
Did you write home to your parents?
All the time. Yes, indeed. I wrote Mama and them every week. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I kept a letter going up there.
Did they send you letters?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I've got some of them around here somewhere. I think Roz has done gobbled them up. And she's putting together a thing for the family, too, you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wrote. Then when I went overseas, finally, got overseas, I wrote Miss Gumby, my wife, every day.
So had you married her before? Did you marry her during World War II?
I sure did. Yes, sir.
What was that courtship like? I mean, you had told me that you were singing in the thing. And
well, I met her in 43.
Uh-huh.
And that's when we formed this group. And her father was a minister there in Abilene. So we would sing at her church and all over town, and we drew some pretty good crowds up there. the offerings, you know, collections were pretty good. So they got so they kind of liked me, you know. But we married in July 18, 1946. That's when we got married.
What made you decide to get married?
Well, I kind of wanted her, you know, because...
Was this after the war? Can you remember?
I don't know where the war had ended. The war ended in 46.
Right,
And we got married in July of 46. And our first child was born in April 47.
Okay.
And it was either that or, you know, I had somebody back home supposedly waiting on me.
Okay. So after the war, what did you do?
Well, after the war, I went home, and then I couldn't find no job. So I re-enlisted and went back in.
Mm-hmm. And you brought your wife back home?
Oh, yeah, brought the wife back home. Yeah,
and when you say you couldn't find any job, what kind of experiences did you have?
Well, I was, what I did, I went back to Pennsylvania to get my old job back, working with the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
But they was all filled up. You know, I forget how many millions of men we had out of arms under World War II.
Right, right.
And the minute the war was over, the floodgate was open. And by the time I got out, they had just about taken up all the jobs. You know, the good jobs.
Right, right.
I probably could have went on a farm or something like that, but I thought I was bigger than that, you know, by then. And I had worked up pretty good. I wasn't no staff sergeant. I was a technical sergeant then. I sure was when I got out. And I re-enlisted. And,
how long did it take you to decide to re-enlist?
Not very doggone long. I didn't stay up but about 2 weeks. My break in service was about 2 weeks in all them 27 years.
So you made up your mind right away to go
right
back?
To go right back.
And so did you go back into the Army?
Went in the Air Force.
What made you shift military unit?
Well, by that time, I was what they call SCARWOF. Now, you see, the Air Force had, Truman did this too, the Air Force had separated and became a separate service just like the Army.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we got the four, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. See? Back when I first got in, it was the Army Air Force.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the Air Force got so big that they wanted to be by themselves. So it was better, since they were newer and everything, I figured that I could move up faster since they didn't have anybody doing what I was doing.
Right.
Okay? So when I joined them, I just read up in, well, I was SCARWOF, then I transferred over to the Air Force permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over in what they call in grade, using the same serial number, you know. Only thing I changed it from R or A, regular Army, to Air Force, AF, 502-33-885. That was my serial number.
You remember.
Oh, you can never forget that kind of stuff. See, you were taught in the military that when the enemy got you, there was only two things that you could repeat, your name and your serial number. Never anything else. If you gave them any other information, you could be accused of high treason. Your name, my name is Harry Lester Gumby. My serial number is AF 305-882.
When you re-enlisted, where did you do this?
Did it right there on the base. Yeah.
In Pennsylvania.
No, I was in Columbus, Ohio.
In Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, sir. Did it right there. Held up one hand. Well, you get out one day, and then you go back the next day. See, the same day that you're out, you can't go back in the same day. But I had a 2-week break.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went on in there, held it up. And then they gave me my re-enlistment bonus. And, oh, boy, I was in pretty good shape. I had a pocket full of money and everything like that. Nice little wife, baby on the way. I said, hey, I'm set here. And I had worked up to the rank where, you know, when you get a certain rank, you know, they give you a place to live on the base and all that kind of stuff. Oh, Lord, I'm telling you, it was royal. Yeah. The service was a good place to be as long as there's no fighting going on.
When you re-enlisted, where was the base? It was in Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Were you in segregated quarters?
Let me tell you what happened. No, sir, the whole base was black. Let me tell you what happened. Oh, this is an interesting thing. The Kentucky Airmen, the 99th, they were the 99th and the 301st wing, bomb wing. They had been in Italy, and over there they were known as the Red Tails. Okay? The Red Tails were black airmen who flew P-51s. And I don't know how many missions they flew escorting the bombers in and out over the territory, and never lost a one. Never lost a one, and never lost an airplane. Them suckers were good. Now, when they brought them back from overseas, show you that we hadn't really got this thing together yet in America yet. Now these were American people, born and reared here, educated here, all that kind of good stuff, and fighting for this country, for our flag. They brought them back to the States and sent them down to Godman Field, Kentucky, right outside Louisville. And the white folks down there said, we don't want them colored fellas down here in Kentucky. We don't want them. Get them out of here. You got to get the whole shebang out. So they had this base in Ohio called Lockbourne Air Force Base, which was 17 miles south of Columbia. They moved them all from Godman Field up to Lockbourne.
And that's where you were?
That's where I got with them.
Oh, you got with them. You weren't
yeah.
there originally.
No, I wasn't there when they got there. I came there later. But I tell you, that was the finest. Oh, I learned something. Listen, they didn't know that when they did that, buddy, they just gave us the best chance to really prove that we could do anything that anybody else could do in the world. Let me tell you what happened. We were integrated there. General Quesada, Mexican general, came down. He was segregated against too. Never made 4 stars. He came down from the 9th Air Force, which was in Virginia. And he said, we're doing this all wrong, but it's orders from the president. He says, you know, we should integrate the white into you guys instead of breaking you up and sending you over here. So they need to come to this base and get some expertise on how bases run. Said, this is great over here. Said, you guys got the best thing going for each other, man. And they got together and they said, but we got to break it up. So they did. Now, my first station, never will forget this, in 1949, I guess it was, 8 or 9, after I left Lockbourne, was in Cleveland. Cleveland is up north. Everything's supposed to be great up there. Went to Cleveland, Ohio, little old town called Berea. First place, we went up there, and we couldn't find no place to live. So we went way out in some old barracks that they had built during World War II, and they had some industry workers working in them, and they had turned them into homes. So that's where I found out a place for me and my wife. And by that time I had 2 children to live in. But anyhow, when we went to Berea, Ohio, to the Air Force base, they wouldn't give the black fellas no job. Now, we were schooled in the military, and I'm telling you, child, we were good. By that time, I had worked up to a master sergeant. I thought I was tough. Really, I did.
Right.
I mean, I thought I was something else. You know, I thought that I could do anything that needed to be done right. And so, let me tell you what happened. They had this Air Force Reserve Wing. That's when they started this active reserve business. And it's carried on to this day. And I didn't like it then, I don't like it now, because they started putting the women in there, and they sent them to, I had a niece here, just got out of here about 3 months ago, had been in Afghanistan, Iran, and then twice from this active reserve stuff. Well, it's all right if you stick it out and there ain't no war, but it's, women in war just don't work. And I just don't like, it's not a thing for women to get into. War is for men. Okay. And that's really not. But anyhow, what happened was they had this reserve air wing with the pilots and all. There was like 900 of these people. And we called them weekend warriors. Every week, a certain number of them came out for training. And we were there to train them. But they wouldn't give us no job. I was supposed to be running the infirmary. That was my job. Okay? I had a 6-bed infirmary there. I'm supposed to be bossing that. You know, they had a guy who was 2 ranks lower than me in charge, a white boy. I didn't say nothing. See, in the military, whether you work or whether you sleep all the time, you still get a check at the end of the month. So, why should I? You know, I knew what I was sent there to do. I knew what I could do. And I was getting paid every month. So why should I kick the butt? Why somewhere? Because I knew it was going to come to a head one day. And it did. The Inspector General, just before the Korean War broke out, the Inspector General came down there to check the unit to see if they were ready to go to war, to active duty. Totally white unit. There's 8 of us blacks in it. All came from black, from Lockburn, mm-hmm. from the black air base. All went to Cleveland. None of us had it.
Inspector General came yeah. just before Korea in
right.
Ohio.
Right,
Facebook.
Right. The Inspector General, the IG, came in and to inspect the forces there to see if they were ready to go on active duty. And they failed the inspection. So the first thing this big colonel did was got all the officers and all the non-coms together. And he chewed us up one side, across our head, and down the other side. And called us everything but child of God. And said, how could you let this happen? So for some reason or other, they always try to pick me as a spokesman. I don't know why. But the guys looked over at me and nodded their head. So we had, you know, our quiet, communicative ways of getting around. And so I held up my hand. And I said, Colonel, can I speak? And he said, Sergeant, I'll be glad to hear what you've got to say. And I said, well, first of all, I said, that's the best chewing out I've ever got. I've been in this military since 43. And I said, I've never had a butt chewing like you laid on us today. And I said, but you gave it to the wrong people. I said, we don't even have a job here. I said, we've never had an assignment here. And the juggler stood out in his veins stood out in his neck that big. And his face turned as red as a beet. He almost had a stroke. And he said, Sarge, what are you talking about? I said, well, let me give you an example, sir. I said, I work for a staff sergeant. He hit the floor. He said, you're not in charge down where you are, Sarge? said, I work for Stafford. I said, he's a pretty nice little fella and all. I said, but he's in charge. I'm not. He said, who's commander of that unit over there? That captain, if a hole could have opened up and swallowed him, he'd have been gone. He was so embarrassed, put out. And he says, well, you're in charge now, Sarge. I said, well, Colonel, I tell you, you send your team, this was on Friday, I said, you send your team back down there at 8 o'clock Monday morning. And I said, we'll go through the procedures again. I said, send them down. He said, we'll do that, Sarge. He said, anybody else in there? So all the rest of them said, we don't have a job either, sir. Oh, he fired them commanders right on the spot. Oh, listen, them guys almost, you know, I don't know whether we got court-martialed enough, because shortly after that we left. When I say shortly after that, the wing failed, and we all got new assignments. They sent me to New York. So they sent me to Mitchell Field. I'm way out on Long Island, if you've ever been to New York. But that's where they sent me. But that's what happened, you know. And listen, we got busy. And so when I went back down to the unit, you know, the word had gotten down. And I said, well, fellas, you know, I guess I'm in charge. And I said, you guys know me and I know you. I said, the only difference is, you know, I give instruction now. I didn't say orders. And I said, now, anybody don't want to work for me? I said, there's the door. Nobody left. Nurses stayed, doctors stayed. They said, Sarge, we've been waiting for this. Well, the old first sergeant, who was really a prejudiced dude, I saw him about an hour after that. So he starts saying, listen, man. I said, I don't even talk to you. I said, I don't even want to say nothing to you, and don't you say anything to me. I said, because you knew what happened. And I said, you were embarrassed because you made the embarrassment. I said, don't say anything. And I said, you better not say anything to that. I said, because I told them and gave them a chance to leave. And they said, Sarge, we're staying. I said, so you know what that means. They're going to do what they need to do. Monday morning, we were ready. Oh, it was the worst thing I ever said. But, you know, it happened. And I knew the unit was a mess when we got there. But, you know, you can't do a thing. You know, when people in charge, it's like anything else, you know. They have the say-so, the authority, and so with that is supposed to go responsibility. But that's what happened with that big thing. But the other thing, and what I'm on that vein of saying, all the while I was in the service, maybe with the exception of, well, it even happened there. I was thinking about my Hawaiian tour. It seems as though I always had to prove myself. I don't know. But it didn't worry me, because I always thought I was ahead of the job, and that by being ahead of the job, you know, then you knew what to do to get the job done, and so you just stayed ready for it.
So let's just go through your career in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So after the 49, then where did you went? You said you went to New York.
Yeah, I went to New York. After I left Ohio, I went to New York. Out to Mitchell Field, Long Island, and I was supposed to be working in a hospital up there. Mm-hmm. And when I got up there, they had a mix-up in assignments. I don't know how this happened, but there was a guy in the position that I was supposed to be in there, and he didn't even know I was coming. And so I said, well, it's okay, man, you know. And I happened to outrank him. He was a white fellow, and I happened to outrank him. I said, "Man, don't you worry about this thing." I said, "I don't like it up here anyhow." And he said, "You don't?" I said, "No." And he said, "What you gonna do?" I said, "Well, I said tomorrow morning I'm gonna call the Pentagon, and I said, and just tell them what happened, you know." And so they had a sign with Section 9 and everything. And so he said, well, where do you think they might send you? He said, "You don't want to go back overseas." I said, "No, I don't want to go overseas." I said, I'd like to go to Texas if I could. I said, "But if they ain't, wherever they got a space." So they sent me down to Trenton, New Jersey, a place called McGuire Air Force Base down there. They had a unit down there, and so they sent me down there. And I went on down there, and same thing happened. When I got there, they had a guy who was one rank under me who was in charge. Well, normally the highest ranker, you know, takes over. So I told him, "Oh, man, don't worry about me, you know, but then, you know, I'm used to this kind of thing." I said, "You know, just remember, you know, that when, you know, we get down to nitty-gritty, you know, that, you know, you're in charge. And just tell them so, you know, even though they know I'm here." And it was really embarrassing for him, you know, it really was. And so two or three times he, when something had to go out of the union or something like that, he'd ask me to sign it. I said, "Well, you know, I'm really not supposed to do that, you know." I said, "You know, because I'm not in charge over here." I said, "What I'm doing is certifying that this is me and it's like it's supposed to be, and everything's okay." And I said, "You're doing a good job. You're doing a good job." So I stayed there for, I don't know, maybe, I must have hung around there for at least 2 years. And then one day a guy called me and he said, "You know, we got this assignment up in Pepperell Air Force Base." I said, "Well, where in the world is that, man?" He said, "St. John's, Newfoundland." I said, "Oh, that ain't too bad." Newfoundland's what, maybe 900 miles north of New York City, just the other side of Canada. And he said, "I've been up there," and he said, "it's a pretty good base." I said, "You need a sergeant major up there." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." So I said, "Okay, go ahead and write up the orders and we'll go up." And he said, "You can take your family up there with you." I said, "No, I'm not taking my family up there no place until I check it out and see what's going on." I said, "They're going to stay right back here in the States." And so I sent them on to Pennsylvania. And I'm glad I did, because it gave my folks a chance to see their grandchildren, that sort of thing. So I went on up to St. John. Got up there, girl, and what happened was they had another fella in the job that I was supposed to be in. I said, "Well, now, how in the world they get these assignments mixed up?" And so we laughed about it, and he said, "Oh, Harry," he said, "we can both do this job." He said, "We're getting paid, you know, and the same thing, and I'm taking." I said, "Yeah." I said, "But it just doesn't seem like it's the way it's supposed to be." And he said, "Well, I tell you what," he said, they got a hospital in BW1. Well, BW1 was in Greenland. The Sisowak Air Force Base up in Greenland. And he said, "You ever been up there?" And I said, "No, I've never been to Greenland." he said, "Well," he said, "the tour is shorter up there." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, I don't mind." I said, "Since I'm over here," and I said, "Greenland's only another 600-700 miles further north, I just about as well go up there and take a look at them Eskimos and see what's going on up there." And so we got the assignments and everything together. So I went to Greenland. I stayed up there 2 years. Had a wonderful time. I didn't take the family up there. Greenland, you know, is night sun, and also you also have total darkness too,
right,
for about 3 of the months. So but it worked just well with what I was doing, because we had a lot of guys there that could take the daylight, but they couldn't take the night. Mm-hmm. And it was all psychological. And they did the worst thing in the world. whiskey was cheap up there, and they'd get to drinking, you know, and that's a no-no. You know, when you get to drinking, you get the DBs, then you get to seeing things, and then you get hallucinating, and all kind of things happen to you. So I didn't drink, never had drank. When I was a boy growing up, we weren't allowed to drink or smoke. And I kind of kept that all through all the years. And so I was able to kind of help a lot of the guys get through. Had two or three guys who went off on the deep, you know, and we brought them back, you know, in a box and that sort of thing. They, you know, they just couldn't handle it. And so, you know, it was, you know, we did our duty up there. I was in the Air Force by the time, and we used Greenland was, you know, we were having all that Cold War problem with Russia during that time, you remember? And they figured that if the Russians ever hit the United States, they would come over Thule, Greenland, on into BW-8, which was Sanderstrom, into one, which, and I was on the south tip. I was like 120 nautical miles from where the Titanic went down. Now, that's where I was up there. And so we had different radar sites and them, you know, they didn't have Doppler and all this other fancy stuff that they got, you know, all that. They don't need that now. But that's the way, you know, we were a force to protect the United States from attack.
Mm-hmm.
And what
did you do in particular?
I was a medic.
Okay,
I ran the hospital. I stayed as a medic, ran the hospital. Sergeant Major ran the hospital. We had a 36 bed hospital up there, and nurses and everything. And the Danish at that time, I guess, belonged in Denmark. Denmark owned Greenland, I guess, and we were just kind of renting over there,
right?
And that kind of thing.
How did they accept you as African American?
Oh my goodness! Yeah. By that time, things had moved out, and it was very little prejudice, you know. The only incident I had up there was with a guy named Wes Moreland. Wes was a white guy. And he was our veterinarian. He was our meat inspector guy. And every time he got paid, he would get drunk. And every time he'd get drunk, he would start a fight, you know? And that's the worst time for a man to fight when he's drunk, because he's easy to get hit and all this kind of stuff. So what happened one time, he'd sent off to his hunt. Well, somebody had sent him some grits. And so he went down to the dining hall and was going to cook these grits and all this kind of stuff. And the mess sergeant down there told him, no, you can't do that. You know, we don't eat no grits here, and we ain't going to let you cook them. And he didn't like grits and all that kind of stuff. So one thing led to another. So they got in a fight. And so they called me, and I went down and saw what the problem was. And so I had my own little thing right there. I said, Wes, now you take them grits and you go on down to my place. I said, I got a hot plate and everything down there. I said, you can cook them down there. I said, buddy. He said, well, I don't see why I can't. He said, I can't understand. I said, well, some guy, you know, just don't eat grits. Mm-hmm. And I think the mess sergeant, you know, it's like, you know, everybody thinks black's like watermelon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't, you know, and some who do, they don't like people to know that they like it, you know. And I'm sure that Swaggart, that was his name, that Swaggart ate grits, but he just wasn't going to let this guy cook them in his dining hall. So I let Westmoreland cook the grits down there. And I said, every time you get some grits, I said, you come down here. I said, we'll cook them up, and you and I eat them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it takes sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So was your family still in...
No, they came to Texas while I was overseas.
Okay.
Yeah, every time I went overseas, they went.
You wouldn't take them out?
Oh, no. Oh.
Why?
Well, first place, it was too much fooling and moving around, you know. And I wanted, I never wanted my children to grow up on a military installation, because the culture is different. And now they got into the movement, and I still think sometimes they get a little restless. But this was the longest place that we ever stayed right here when I brought them here. And the children finished school here, they finished college here.
When you say here, where?
Right here in Grandview.
Mm-hmm. When did you get to Grandview?
We were in 64.
So how long were you in Newfoundland and Greenland?
Oh my goodness. I was up there 4 or 5 years in both places, and then I came back to the States for quite a while, and back again, back to Texas. And then I went to Hawaii, and I spent a little over 4 years over there, and I came from Hawaiian Islands here.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So what were you doing in Hawaii?
In Hawaii, I ran an aeromedical evacuation squadron. Aerovac, we called it.
Oh, yeah.
And what it was, we had a group of airplanes, and this time we had gone to the jet airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And on the back of these airplanes, we had a big red tail. And we used to go into the war zone and pick up the injured service people and their families, too, if they lived over there and got sick. And we'd bring them first to Hawaii and then back to the States. And that's flew them back and forth across there. And we had this whole squadron of people. Now, in this squadron, in this AirVac squadron, I had corpsmen, I had nurses, and one doctor, okay? And the nurses were what they called flight nurses. They wore a flight uniform, nursing uniform, and they treated the sick on the airplane. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the doctor, he was there for any number of different kind of things. And my job was strictly administrative. I made sure that they had the right equipment, that they had the right people, and the crew was part of the what we call the aeromedical crew, and they were assigned to a plane, and they went all overseas. Then periodically, I used to take flights over, and I'd go. We call them round robin check rides, and I would go every place that they went, to Japan, to the Philippines, down into the Aleutians, wherever they went, and just kind of see how the guys would do, and then spent a great deal of time in the Philippines, and all down in there. Never did get into Vietnam, but we hauled a lot of people out of there.
Well, listen, before Vietnam, how was Korea? How did, when we had that conflict rather than war,
yeah.
Well, what was it like serving in the military during that time period?
They had me ready to go to Korea 2 or 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how in the world I ever got out of it. But it was a, you know, we still got a bunch of people over there now. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I imagine maybe 40, 50,000. And we leave there, them boys from North Korea are going to march down on them.
Right. But you never had to go to Korea.
Never. I never went to Korea, never went to Vietnam.
So when Vietnam started, did you, where were you during the Vietnam?
All right. I was slated for Vietnam when I got out. See, when you get in the military, the longer you stay, the more people you meet. And so when I came back from Hawaii in 64, I came out here to Richard Gebauer. And in 69, 5 years later, they came out with a policy that said that if you had 20 years in and you've been overseas X number of times, you didn't have to go back no more. Well, I didn't believe that for that time. No, I didn't believe it. Because the military changes, so. And so I found out who was, by that time, for the Air Force societies, they had changed the assignments to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. And I called down there one day, checking my record, on a record check and all this kind of stuff. And somehow or other, my name got bandied around down there, but this guy called me, and he's a guy that I'd served with, and in the service, they use your nickname a lot. This guy called me Gum, like G-U-M. Gum, he said, man, he said, I didn't even know where you were and what happened to you. I said, well, I'm up here in Missouri. And I said, he said, well, you're Dickie Goober. That's a nickname they'd given his base. I don't know where they got that from. I said, yeah, I'm a Dickie Goober. And he said, you know what? He said, ain't you about ready for an overseas assignment? I said, no, I'm not. And he said, well, I'll be watching out for you. Well, I said, good. So I guess a month later, this guy called me. And he said, Gum, and he said, you know what? He said, you ready to get out and retire? And I said, yeah, I'm about ready to go. And he said, you don't want to go to 30? I said, well, if they let me alone, I'll go to 30. And he said, well, I think your name will be up in the next 3 or 4 weeks. I said, you kidding? And I said, where? He said, Cameron Bay. I said, you got to be kidding. I said, I'm protected by the last instruction to come out. He said, no. He said, you're not. He said, all us old soldiers, I'm going to have to go myself if I stay. And I said, well, okay. He said, well, you know what to do. I went that afternoon and put in my retirement papers.
You weren't going to Vietnam.
Weren't going. I went and put them in. And had the Kirk type them out, put them in and everything. 3 weeks later, I walked into the hospital one morning. Well, after I did this, I just kind of, I had talked it all over with Brendan, Roz, and all of them. They said, well, Dad, we think you've done enough. I said, you've played your allegiance. And said, we don't want you to go nowhere but out of there. Mm-hmm. And says, you can come on out here and get your job. Said, if you don't get no job, go on back to school. Finish your education. I said, okay, guys. 3 weeks later, I went to the hospital one morning. I went in there, and everybody was sad and drunk. And wasn't nobody saying nothing. And so Carol Ball, never will forget, bless her heart, white girl who worked for me. She was a secretary and receptionist in Walvis, and good. This over here, Lee Summit. And she started crying. I said, what's going on around here? I said, somebody died? They said, no. I said, Chief, said your assignment's in. I said, yeah. And they said, you're scheduled to go to Cameron Bay. I said, really? They said, yeah. I said, oh, boy. I said, I don't think I want to go over there. They said, well, how are you going to get out of it? Oh, I said, well, I just think I'll retire. I'm playing with them now, a little bit.
Right.
So after they all settled down that afternoon, you learn a little mischievous too. A lot of times we'd all eat in the dining room together, and the workers could eat in there too, they had to pay. So I waited till they all got in the dining room. So I said, well, guys, I said, I got about another 3 more weeks here before I can eat in your nice dining hall here. And I said, then when I come out to eat in here, I'll have to eat in here as a civilian. They said, what's going on? I said, well, I'm retired in 3 weeks. They said, you're retired? Said, it's all over the hospital that you're going to Vietnam. I said, well, no, I decided not to go. They said, well, you can't get out of that. So I reached in my pocket, and I passed this thing all right. It was a copy that I made. I said, here, send this around. Let these folks read it. They said, well, you've been carrying this around for 3 weeks? I said, I have. I said, listen, I haven't been in this place for no 27 years, not know what the ropes are, mm-hmm. and how they go. I said, you learn a little bit of something that gives you advantage. And they said, well, so you get that. I said, yep. Well, the commander, he called me over. Oh, matter of fact, he passed here just a few months ago. Nice guy, Colonel. He called me over. And he said, Sarge, he said, you left us down. I said, so I listened to him, very respectful. But listen, I was in the service when that guy was still in college. You know what I mean? And so I listened to what he had to say and all that. And I told him, I said, well, I'll consider it. Mm-hmm. But I had already considered when
right,
I went
sure.
in. You know, it did. That was a terrible war. We lost a lot of guys over there. A lot of my friends went over there and never came back. Now I understand we're friends with all of Vietnam. And it's just like it never happened.
Right.
We got trade things going with them and all that. And that's what war does. Now, this thing in Korea, I don't know how in the world we'll ever get that. And I hope that Iran and Afghanistan doesn't turn into the same thing. I was glad to see them bring all those guys home the other day. And the vice president's son, I think, was among the first ones to come back.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a terrible thing. War is awful. Even though we can pray for it, you're never ready for it. It's just terrible.
So when you got out of the military, then what did you do?
The day I got out, I had a job. They had these health centers all around over the country, health clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And they had them in impoverished areas. And they had one down here called Wayne Minor Health Clinic, or Health Center.
Mm-hmm.
It was at 9th and Euclid. And I had sent my resume down there, and they called me down there. And Joe Harkin, I'll never forget. Joe was from a little town out here in Kansas, graduate of University of Kansas, and a great guy, good administrative fellow. He was from, you know, when you go down 35 and just before you go on the freeway, what is that down there? I can't think of it right now
okay,
to call.
All right.
Yeah, but you go down I-35 through Kansas, and then just before you get to the turnpike, you break through that little town down there. And that's where he was from. So he read my resume, and he said, my goodness gracious, says, this is what we need down here. I said, ooh, my goodness. So he told Doctor, we had a black guy named Dr. Rogers, who was the center director. And he said, Doc, he said, you better get this guy before he gets away from you. They called me and asked me to come down. So I went down, and Doc said, well, Joe has read your resume. He said, I haven't read it yet, but he's telling me that, you know, we better get you before you get away. He says, when are you getting out of service? I said, well, I'm getting out in a day or two. I said, but I'm going back home and take my family back there, and I'll be gone a month.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, where's back home? I said, Pennsylvania. And I'm going to Texas, too, and all this kind of stuff. They said, okay. So they hired me. And I worked down there for off and on for over 20 years. And ran the center. I was an administrator. And in the meantime, I went back to school. I graduated from Park. I have a major in sociology, minor in administration. And I just did that for record purposes,
right,
really.
Right.
Yeah. And so
you enjoy learning.
Oh, I loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. And
in terms of your experience as a soldier, since you've made the military your career, what have you enjoyed the most about it? That experience.
Well, I would say that I met a lot of nice people. And not only that, but I learned some things, tactics, we like to call them in the military,
mm-hmm.
that in the military that helped me in management situations out here. For example, I was having some problems down at the center with some of the managers they had a problem with me because I had the management experience but didn't have a degree. I wasn't thinking about that. In the military, if you're in charge and you had a responsibility, you are just that. No matter whether you got 10 degrees or none at all. They're looking for you to do that particular job, be responsible for that job, and for it to meet the levels of efficiency that the job requires. Okay? And so, I guess I'd been there about 3 years, and I told Doc one day, I said, you know, I'm going to leave here. And he said, I said, these people ain't never going to learn. So he said a very simple thing to me. He said, well, Harry, he said, you know why that is? And I said, well, why is it? He says, you're trained, and they're not. And that clicked in my head. And I thought about that. And I said, yeah, I am trained to do what I do.
Right. And that makes all the world a difference.
Makes a difference.
And with experience.
With experience. So that means that I had to train them.
Right.
And once I got that going, everything just kind of leveled out. And I've spent, I'm going to tell you what happened. not too long ago, well, let's see. This is 04, 05. Back about 05, they got into real trouble down there.
Mm-hmm.
And they called, they went to through two directors down there.
Wow.
So somebody on the board said, well, why don't we call Mr. Gumby and ask him to come back down here and straighten this place up? And so they did, and I went down. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm not looking for any job. And I said, no, my wife's sick, and I'm trying to take care of her and all that. And they said, oh, Mr. Gumby, said we need you down here. Said we'll pay you. So I rely on Rod and Brendan and them. They've been through the mill now, and they're retired and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I said, guys, what do you think? They said, don't you dare go down near that place. Said, the first place, it acted like you're getting ready to fold up. And they said, if you're there when it happens, said, your name will be all over this town. They said, we wouldn't be able to take it. Well, I had never thought of it like that. Because I really hadn't thought about if I went down there that it was going to fail.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And that was me thinking. But they were thinking just, so I had to lean toward that. So I told them no. But I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, I'll come down here and show you what to do to get things straight. And I won't charge you anything. I said, now how you like that? Oh, they said, we want you to come on. I said, no, I said, I'm not going to hire on. I said, I had enough of that, and I don't want any more headaches like that. I said, but you give me a person that you think that can understand what it is that we need to do here and can get it done, and I'll take them through the ropes, show them how to do it, lead them through, carry their hand if you want me to.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, okay. So I went down, and in the meantime, I had a lady that was pretty smart, that had worked for me before down there. And she had ran into some health problems, and anyhow she got squared away. And I ran to her one day and I told her, I said, you know what? I said, I can get you a job down there as a director at a place, you know, if you want to take it. And I said, I'll help you. And I said, I don't want to be paid. I said, now when you go in there, I said, everything that we did when I was there before, they did away with that. I said, that's why they're in trouble. I said, they don't have any directives, no management directives, you know, they don't even have an organizational chart. I don't know how they were running it. And I said, all of that's gone. And I said, now, if you're willing to deal with that and to kind of work that back up again. So she went in there, and I think she stayed around there a couple of years until they got a director. And they were paying pretty close to $100,000. But it's not always the money that you need. I still have a good spot in my heart and my mind for the place, because it's the first place that I went to work after I got out of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to relearn a lot of things about civilian life that I had forgotten about, and that place taught them to me.
And your family by this time was living right here?
Oh yeah, they were all living right here. I had two girls graduated from KU. I had
okay, their names, please?
Yeah, Rosalyn.
Rosalyn, she gave me her graduation.
Right. And the other one was Arvetta. Arvetta, her name is now Arvetta Gumby Pruitt. She graduated from KU.
What, you, Was she about what years? Do you remember the years?
Oh, let me see.
Is she older or younger than Roz?
She's younger than Roz.
Okay.
So she was, she graduated after Roz did.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think Roz has got her master's from over there too, I believe,
yeah,
doesn't she?
Uh-huh,
yeah.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. She's pretty smart.
So, well, that's good. And did your wife ever work outside the home?
Oh, yes. My wife was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Where did she teach?
She finished Abler, and she taught in the Kansas City School District downtown here.
Okay.
Uh-huh. She taught the elementary.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, yeah. And she's a music teacher, too. That's why we got them instruments there.
Right. She's music as well.
Yeah, she did music, too. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever join any veterans organizations or activities after the military or during the military?
The only one I belong to is the DAV, Disabled American Veterans.
Uh-huh.
As far as I'm concerned, it's the best one.
Why do you say that?
Well, they give more help to the veterans than anybody. Oh, they
but
jump.
But you yourself are not disabled, are you?
No. I'm fine.
Uh-huh. And so you, those are the ones that you are dedicated.
Yeah, but that's one. Every year I give them a monetary donation. Anybody that I find that gets in any kind of difficulty, the headquarters in St. Louis, mm-hmm. I give them the number, tell them who to call, tell them if they have some problems, get back with me,
mm-hmm.
and they've never failed to get the kind of help that they need. Matter of fact, I'm helping a widow now, whose husband was a friend of mine, who lived in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, I got to call her right back after I finish talking to you, and give her some information. But it's a good organization.
How do you think the military experience has influenced your life?
Well, I think that one of the great things that I learned, I guess, from the military has sort of a culture all of its own. And what I mean by that is that they have a form of buddy system in the military where they help people who seem to be in need of help,
mm-hmm.
financial help, whatever kind of help they get, and they rush together and surround that person, group of them, and help them. In other words, it's like we take care of our own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we need more of that everywhere,
mm-hmm.
out here. The other thing is, I learned that unless you're really committed,
mm-hmm.
to getting something done, that you're not. You know, with the commitment has to also go the dedication.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, of course, comes the results, which is normally good.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn to cop this kind of stance, that if it's worth doing,
mm-hmm.
it's worth giving it your best. It's worth giving your best. You also learn that, number one, that we all might talk the same. Some of us might look the same, but we all don't think and do the same thing. And so you learn a tolerance for that. You learn a patience for that. There are some people who work hard at things, as hard as they can, but never seem to get anywhere. And so with just a word here, or one word here, or just a little movement here, it just sets them up so that they can go get that done without any more difficulty. And Then I guess one of the great things I think I learned from the military was to be patient. I learned the act of being patient because patience, according to the scripture, does its perfect work when you are patient and don't rush to conclusion. Stop and take a look at things, and maybe what that person's doing, they don't know what else to do, or they don't know how to do it any better or any efficiently. And so you learn to have some tolerance of that. And it works. It works. It works. A lot of politics in the military, a lot of politics everywhere. And so you deal with them as you meet them, whatever comes up, and with them sometimes. There's always some politics, as I always say, are relative. It's who's playing them and why he's going that way, or why she's going that way, or what aims they're going to get out of it. And maybe you might get a little something about it, maybe you might not. And it's one of the things that I think that has gotten us sort of into the bind that we're in now, you know, because there are certain groups of people who might have lots of wealth and lots of money who want things to go the way they want them to go, even though we know that they might have an impact on somebody else further down the road, and usually do.
Well, I thank you very much for your time.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Sharing this, and yeah. We'll probably have to talk again.
All right.
Thank you very much.
I'll be glad to.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.